Hello, everyone, and welcome to NWR Connectivity, episode 330. I'm your host, John Reardon, and I am joined, as I usually am, by Neil Ronahan.
Wow, has been 1 week already? Oh, no, it's been two.
Yeah, we didn't do an episode last week because we didn't want to. I don't actually remember. I think you kind of were busy.
I had a concert. It was a date night because I was going to go to a concert, but then one of the band members got COVID, and then I wound up seeing Thor with my wife.
Yeah, you were busy. I think I was working on a Xenoblade video, so yeah, just didn't.
Go watch it.
Yeah.
It's all about Xenoblade lore, and it's, like, really good.
But speaking of RPGs, we also have Jordan Rudick.
I can't believe I wasn't invited to Neil's date night. Now you set a really sour note Thor? Here. I haven't seen Thor yet. I do want to see it.
How could he? He wasn't invited to your date night.
That's true. I was waiting for the invite, so now I got to make my own plans.
He wasn't going to see it without you.
Sorry, you couldn't join me to go to have some love and thunder with me and my wife.
Yeah, it was my hope for 2022 to be your third wheel more often, but I'll settle for doing that on connectivity, I guess.
We have a little bit of news this week. Well, honestly, there's been quite a bit of small pieces of news since we last recorded, but the only one we're really going to worry about, Mario Strikers Battle League got
Kirby
its first
Extreme Buffet. Yeah, I mean,
yes.
Mario Strikers.
Directs are dead, and we're just doing Twitter drops from now on. That's it.
Which works better? Sorry, internet.
I mean, honestly, it's like
we've
been talking about a theoretical June Direct for a month and a half.
I was telling somebody about this at work because they were complaining about no Nintendo Direct, and I was like, dude, remember how you stopped talking about the PlayStation and Xbox presentations a week after they happened, and how you've been talking about Nintendo since the beginning of June? That's why they didn't do one, and it's working.
And they didn't have Zelda. I do think if Zelda was 2022, oh, absolutely, they would have had a big June presentation.
Sure.
I mean, with no Zelda or Mario, why do a big, huge first party direct? You know, you can just drop all this news individually.
I mean, they did one for Xenoblade, which was
true. Yeah,
kind of their thing. I'm sure they'll do one for Splatoon and Pokemon as those get closer.
Yeah.
Yeah,
no doubt.
I'm surprised we haven't gotten any Pokemon news since the beginning of June.
We've got a while, you know. Yeah. I think they're getting pretty obsessive about about giving everything its time, unless you're Live Alive, of course. But everything else gets
Live Alive? Is that a video game? Or I just thought Xenoblade was next.
Xenoblade is the only RPG. but yes, Mario Strikers Battle League, it got an update. They added Daisy. Now shut up.
Shy Guy's there too.
Also Shy Guy, but
he looks adorable.
You know, weirdly, the internet isn't talking about Shy Guy, despite, like, with his stats, honestly, will probably be a much more useful character.
Yeah, because Shy Guy is basically just neutral everything. So
like, he is true neutral.
Yeah, with what you do with the gear could make that character fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
I wish they would add content to this game and not just characters.
No, now that you've got Daisy and Shy Guy, that's all you need. You know, I think there was also Nintendo added a tweet after that announcement that, like, oh, this is the end of the DLC. You got Daisy, you got what you wanted. We don't need to add any more content.
Yeah, so we're canceling
the rest. Be happy now. Yeah.
They did add a new stadium. You can now have a desert.
And some new gear.
Yes. Honestly, I mean, if this is, I need to get back in it. Them not having the season start when the game came out just murdered the online for me. And I'll try to go back, but it's going to be difficult.
First off, hi, Matt. And I saw Matt Zawadniak tweet about how, like, I was waiting for Daisy to get into it. And now that Daisy's in it, no one that I know is talking about this game anymore.
Yeah.
So, like, it's fascinating because I know there's all that thing about, like, oh, the sports games are unfinished, which, like, that's not really the case. But with tennis, golf, and now Strikers, there's clearly a pattern that Nintendo's doing. And I would imagine that if they're doing this for the third time over 4 years, I imagine that they probably have some data saying that this works, keep it in the news cycle, you know, launch it, and then just over the course of, like, you know, 6 to 9 months, maybe a year. I forget exactly how long tennis and golf went. I want to say there was, like, 6 months of content for both of them. Just continuously add stuff, and then it keeps it a little bit top of mind, refreshes it at every update that people are like, oh, yeah, there's a golf game, or hey, look at tennis, and then get people to come in. I guess that's working. All the games are selling well. I don't know if that's necessarily the cause or if it's just the Switch bump, but it seems to be doing what they want to do. And I think I'm at a point where I just accept that what Nintendo is doing with Mario sports titles no longer aligns with what I would want out of Mario sports titles.
Yeah.
You'd think they would have saved Daisy till the end of the content drop so that people could keep complaining about no Daisy for the next 12 months, but they blew their load quite early. Yeah. And so now you wonder who else is next, or there's no one else to clamor for.
Diddy Kong and Bowser Jr.
Yeah.
Diddy Kong and Bowser Jr. are the next two, which
it's just more variants of Daisy.
Yeah, that's right.
They're just going to add Daisy in every update. It's what you wanted.
I look at it and I don't know if I'm going to go back to it. And it's kind of a bummer. Like, I historically love Mario Strikers, but it just, I don't find a lot to do in that game.
I will say, I don't have as much experience with the Wii one, so this is mostly coming from the GameCube one, but Strikers for me has always been more of a game that I break out with friends as opposed to a game that I... It's not like the golf or tennis where I play those a bit more single player. So I didn't expect this to hold my interest single player for very long.
It's not even a single player thing. It's that I don't think that online mode is that great.
Yeah. The online mode is frustrating because I feel like it has, there's the potential there.
Yeah.
Like you can kind of see the pieces and like what they want to do, but it's not quite happening.
And yeah, it's definitely a little bit of a limitation of the way that just the Switch does online. But it is, like, it's a cool idea that I just think is not well executed.
All right, I have no segue for how to get into this, but Jordan, well, you reviewed a game, which the review is out by the time this goes up, right? Yes.
Yes, yes, it is.
Okay, you reviewed Live Alive, the oldest new game we've ever reviewed.
And I don't even know if we can call it a single game, because it very much feels like many, many games in one.
Yeah.
Like many lives.
Many lives, aliving. Yes, that's right. as much as I wanted to put like some kind of live or dead pun somewhere in the review, I ended up biting my tongue on that a little bit, but that's okay. I reviewed Live Alive, had the game for a little while, had the chance to write a preview of the game. I think my preview ended up being more positive about the game than my review, and I think that's... I guess that's just kind of the thing that happens when you play through a game and it's fresh and you're enjoying it and you're eager about what's going to happen in the middle and the end, right? That's an RPG for you, right? Like you don't always love the beginning, but you get through it because you know that what's on the other side of that is usually going to be worth that payoff, right? Or there's going to be that payoff at the end. Live Alive is a game where you have seven different protagonists. They each have their own chapter. What's cool is that each of the characters that star in those chapters, it was done by a different artist, so they kind of have a unique look and style to them as well. Once you finish the first seven chapters, an eighth one opens up. The eighth one is cool because it feels like a very traditional RPG. It's got a fantasy setting. You get party members. There's kind of a big bad who kidnaps a princess. And, you know, it's all the kind of familiar, warm and fuzzy RPG things that you like. Before that, though, the seven initial chapters are... a dog's breakfast. You know, you really do get a little bit of everything. You get one chapter that
is... What the hell do you feed your dog?
Yeah. she's eating well. She's pretty tired, but...
A lot of variety.
Yes, yes. You know, whatever we have around the house, pretty much. You know, she's one of those, you know... maybe, you know, for lack of, you know, not disciplining her or not, you know, putting her in line or whatever, but she's a beggar at the table. So when you've got young kids, they're dropping food off the table all the time. So she's literally eating whatever they drop, you know, if that's cereal, if that's veggies, if it's fruits, if it's those things, I'm fine. But if it's, you know, candy, chocolate, whatever, she gets into a little bit of everything, unfortunately. So yeah, she's got the dog's breakfast. I'm playing the dog's breakfast for a view on Switch. But yeah, the seven characters, that's the seven initial chapters you get, they're all over the place. One is kind of reminiscent of Street Fighter, where instead there is no exploration, there's no overworld, there isn't really a lot of not even a lot of dialogue. You're literally just choosing fighters on a fighter select screen and going through them one by one and doing turn-based combat against them. It's kind of hilarious. I actually like that chapter, even though I don't think it stands out, you know, overall, but it's certainly the most, maybe the most unique one out of the bunch. You go to the Wild Wild West, you go to the Distant Future. The Distant Future chapter, you're a cute little robot. Its name is Cube. There's almost no combat in that chapter. It is 2 hours of just storytelling, pretty much. And the story ends up being very compelling, but you have to go through a lot of monotony to get there. And I think that's kind of one of my big takeaways with the game, is that there's a lot of sections where you don't know where it is leading to. And it just feels kind of repetitive and boring. And you're like, you're going through the motions, you know, walking through the same hallways, maybe fighting the same kind of minor enemies, not getting a ton of experience for it, and not really knowing if you should be seeking out more experience and leveling up your characters, because you don't really know what's going to happen at the end of the game. Yeah, Live Alive has been tough to review, tough to play. I think my feelings on it are perhaps, you know, lesser than other people's will be. I do see a lot of enthusiasm about the game, maybe from people who played just the demo, or, you know, they've never experienced it, but they've heard good things about it. You know, this is a game that came out, you know, 30 years ago on the Super Famicom. And I think there's been a lot of people who've talked it up over the years. And so you get a lot of that kind of positive, can you say baggage in a positive way? Like it's got these
cult,
kind of
cult classic level.
Sure. Like, exactly.
Secret of Mana is a game that, yes, I definitely, yeah, had that built up for me, where by the time I played it early 2000s, people were like, oh, it's one of the best Super Nintendo games. Yeah, and it just, yeah, completely fell flat for me. And I guarantee you, if I had played Secret of Mana in like 1995, would have been like over the moon with it.
Well, I think there is a tendency for stuff when you aren't given it, it must be good. You, yeah, know, it's every Star Wars movie that got canceled must have been the better version.
The Colin Trevorrow episode 9 would,
exactly,
have been better.
Like if you didn't get it, it that must be the definitive version. And I think a lot of, like, you know, Japan only Nintendo games could definitely fall into that category. Whether or not they're actually good, it's just that we didn't get them, so they,
so
must,
John, are you saying we should be waiting for the Snyder cut of Live Alive? Is that what we should do?
Honestly, well, isn't that just the original? Because that the original was in 4:3. So
there you go.
They ruined their artistic vision.
Did you guys see the thing about how, like, the Warner Brothers, like, dug into the Snyder cut, and it probably was just like generated by like a digital, or at least the rumor is that, like, Zack Snyder basically orchestrated a fake social media campaign.
That's why I brought it up, because I saw that news, yeah, today or the other day, and I'm like, oh my gosh.
It is hilarious, but it's also so one of those things where, like, if you're Warner Brothers and that gets out, you have to be so embarrassed, because it's like some dude bro just fleeced you for $100 million to, like, make his indulgence picture.
Like, I mean, it's better than being Sony, who put Morbius back in theaters.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's, I mean, maybe that's why they were like, all right, fine, Rolling Stone, we'll talk to you guys, we'll give you the goods.
Yeah,
like, we can't be worse than Sony, who got trolled by the internet to putting Morbius back in theaters, and then it just, like, tanked so hard.
They're both pretty bad when huge studios are kowtowing to, you know, a very vocal minority, and it turns out the minority is completely made up. Yeah, that's pretty, good.
I'm gonna say Snyder Cut, way better than the actual movie.
I believe. Anyway, where's Mother 3?
Yeah, anyway, yeah. Well, I mean, Mother 3 is actually a very good game.
Yeah. Or is it just Japan only?
I hate playing games on a computer, and I played through that game on a computer.
That's fair.
I mean the existence of a Live Alive remake, you know, it certainly lends,
it's cool,
you know, support. It's very cool, and it makes it possible that we will see a Mother 3 remake at some point that maybe can do away with, you know, parts of the game that would set people off, or were reasons why Nintendo didn't want to bring it out in the first place, you know, or bring, yeah, it to the West, I should say. I think, you know, things that are tricky to localize. But I think with Live Alive, I think holding it so close to the original in a lot of ways is maybe to its detriment. I contended in my review that I think Triangle Strategy and Octopath Traveler actually look better, and those games weren't trying to emulate a specific game. Yes, they are, you know, emulating it, that 16-bit style with the HD 2D graphics, but they were kind of starting from scratch in a way too, in terms of what their exact art style, yeah, was going to be. Whereas Live Alive, when you compare them side by side, you can see the characters and the faces, and you can see how it's similar, right? They didn't,
yeah,
it is a gorgeous game, don't get me wrong, the remake looks fantastic, But it does seem held back a little bit by what it was before.
Wait. Are you saying that maybe HD2D isn't the only way that we should ever make old games again? What? Is that maybe something we all should have, like when Octopath came out, but they put every Super Nintendo game like this, maybe that's right. That wasn't the way?
Yeah. I mean, I the idea of remaking things in HD2D is maybe something that I'm going to be less in favor of. I like the idea of using it for new games, like new properties, right? Where you're not trying to emulate something that came before, and then you're so kind of obsessed with trying to straddle this line of new and old that it ultimately holds you back from something great, I think. So that's what I'm seeing with Live Alive anyways. Yeah. And when I was putting the video review together and I was looking at some screenshots of the original version and then comparing them, and I put a couple in the video as well, you really do see, it is kind of glaring that this is not the same kind of step up that we saw with Octopath. And even things like the water effects, the fires, like the sconces in a dungeon, like it's not as impressive as it was, you know, three or four years ago, which is odd to me, right?
Yeah, and it's not just the engine aging. In the screenshots you showed, like it is just a less, it's like it just kind of feels like the game isn't really being crafted for that engine. I mean, comically a bit like, I mean, we mentioned Xenoblade Definitive Edition a second ago. Like it is a bit like that where it's, you know, yes, this is technically using the same engine and features as Xenoblade 2, but one of these things was clearly crafted for this engine. And one of them is being shoved into it.
Also, for listeners confused, we talked about Xenoblade's Definitive Edition while we weren't recording.
Oh, okay. So. It was great. You should have been there.
Yeah. next week when we talk about John's raw Xenoblade 3 talk.
Oh, yeah. We will be able to talk about that next week.
There'll be more Xenoblade Definitive Edition talk coming soon.
I'm just going to open the podcast by spoiling the ending, so look forward to that.
Yeah. it is weird because talking to you is kind of what my fear was with Live Alive. I'm still on board with getting it. I think I'm getting a physical copy, as I'm kind of now getting more in the habit of getting when it's a game that I'm maybe not 100% sure if it's something that maybe I will want to sell that down the road or something like that. Definitely why I'm getting the Xenoblade 3 physical copy. Neil definitely regrets getting the Xenoblade Digital Deluxe Edition, or Xenoblade 2 at launch. But, like, I'm still excited to play it, but it is from that more academic, archaeological perspective of this was a game made by people that went directly from making this game to making Chrono Trigger. And from my knowledge of Live Alive, you can see a lot of what informed, you know, later 90s Square Enix RPGs from this game. And I don't expect it to be as good as Chrono Trigger. Few video games are as good as Chrono Trigger, but I am just interested to see like that kind of like the precursor to a lot of, you know, Square Enix RPG history. It makes me think of like, maybe this is like too harsh of a comparison, but like looking at NES Metroid and then seeing that evolution through 2D Metroid games where you're like, oh, like they had such a good idea here. It is NES Metroid, in my opinion, is maybe a bad game, especially now, but the ideas that it had were fascinating and cutting edge.
They should do an HD2D remake of
they
Metroid.
Should do HD2D remake for everything and just lose all personality and make everything look the same from this like very Bloom heavy. God, I don't hate HD2D. It's just that I don't. I think there's more than one way to remake a game, and we don't need to use the same thing for everything.
I feel like that engine could probably make games that look very different. Like, because all it's really doing is just combining pixel art characters with a 3D environment with a lot of depth of field. Like, the way the textures are being used is not inherent to the engine. That's an artistic choice. You could make games in this engine that look super different. We just aren't for some reason.
Like, I'd like to see games using this engine that aren't RPGs. Like, is that possible? Oh, yeah. I don't know. I don't. It seems like, you know, Square is content to just. What I feel like is this is the way they're going to do turn-based RPGs from now on, right? Like, they've obviously, with Final Fantasy 15, 16, 7 Remake has, like, that hybrid system. But at heart, it's kind of it's an action system.
The 7 Remake turn-based system is, like, dog shit.
No, of course. You know, it's turn-based in the loosest sense of the word, right? Like it has a turn-based element.
They threw that in there in the 11th hour because like, oh yeah. Shit, people are really mad that it's not turn-based. We'll put this in there. It'll shut people up now, and then they'll play the game and be like, oh, who the fuck would play the game like this?
Yeah, but I mean, what I'm trying to say is like, we've got this engine for dedicated turn-based RPGs, and I like that. I like the idea that like, okay, Square Enix is not going to abandon turn-based RPGs and more traditional games like that, and they're just going to charge full price because they look nice. You know, they have this HD 2D system that can make them graphically or aesthetically pleasing to people. So, okay, fine. Keep doing that. Absolutely. I want more turn-based RPGs. But yeah, maybe I don't want remakes of games in this style. Maybe I don't want just RPGs. Maybe we can do something else with this. You know, do a platformer, do an adventure game, a puzzle game, like
3D World Runner in HD 2D. Let's go.
Make it so.
Yeah.
How about remaking one of the old? I mean, I guess they don't own Crystal Dynamics or the Lara Croft Tomb Raider games anymore, right?
Anymore.
You could license it out to THQ.
Yeah. There you go. Okay.
I mean, like options. If HD2D is the way that we're going to get remakes of old RPGs, like, so be it. Like, I'll accept it. It's fine. Like, guess what? Even if Live Alive is a little disappointing, I'm still pretty stoked for Dragon Quest III being remade in HD2D. Like, I still will be interested in that video game. But it just, my thing is that it bugged me, like, when Octopath hit and people were like, wouldn't this be better if it was just Final Fantasy VI? I'm like, one, like, Octopath, for any faults about it, at least it's a new goddamn game. But, like, I don't see it as the end-all be-all for what I want to see out of an old-looking video game. Like, I want to see different approximations of that. Like, I think, honestly, that the Pixel remaster stuff, you know, Lord willing, they're going to come to consoles someday, you spoony bard. But
please.
But, like, that's kind of what I want to see. Like, I'd rather the games look like that than have, like, depth of field and some overabundance of lighting.
The idea that every game should be in a style is ridiculous. Like I certainly agree with you. I do not want that. I want this variety. I want more genres using different art styles. I want, you know, games that we are used to seeing in one way, I want to see them another way. Like, let's keep doing that. Just going back to Live a little bit more, just some more thoughts on it, some more impressions. I feel like it's one of those games, like, where people had a problem with Octopath because it didn't have this, like, you know, way of all the characters interacting and leading to, like, this momentous ending where, you know, there's this huge payoff. I don't think Live has that either. I feel like it does kind of just feel like 7 or 8 distinct stories that they kind of live on their own. They don't, even the stories themselves don't really all end in a satisfying way. So you don't get those kind of, in Octopath, I think you did get those kind of payoffs, right? You did see, like, Tress's ending, and maybe you didn't like it, but it did feel a little bit more final, you know, like for those 8 characters.
The issue for Octopath is that I do think some characters are better than others, but, like, the individual quest lines for each of the 8 characters, I think they were fine. That wasn't the issue. It was the fact that they, like, you would be doing one of the characters, you know, I'm blanking on all the names, like the dancer, Olberic. I remember
Olberic, Cyrus. Yeah.
But, like, you'd get to the end of his quest line and you'd have all these other people in your party, and the fact that they were there meant nothing. Like, that was kind of the issue with Octopath to an extent. Even if I think part of the reason why I was higher in Octopath than maybe, like, most people was the fact that I realize I'm very much like a gameplay systems guy in that regard. And in the battle system, while, like, hilariously cribbed from Mega 10, it's very much like the press turn system.
Yes, totally.
I loved that battle system. I love the way the game looked. The soundtrack's incredible. And I got to a point where I was like, okay, these stories are here, but they are not my drive to play through this game. And that's also maybe part of the reason why I think Live Alive might still land, you know, pretty solidly for me, is because it seems like, from a systems perspective, while, like, I think the battle system is a little weird, it's interesting. And yeah, I think you mentioned it in your review about, like, kind of, you know, maybe poking ahead to see what's going to come in the, you know, like, the final stages of the game, to make sure that I'm not in a position where I'm going to have a bad time. Because I know, so So when you play that game, because I've only messed around with the demo, and a lot of the information that I have about it is from a Retronauts episode that I listened to over a year ago when I was like, maybe I'll play that game someday. But like, as you go through each chapter, it's not like if I were to finish, you know, like the stealth chapter, it's not like if I then go play the Wild West chapter, it's not like the guy from the stealth chapter carries over.
No, they're completely, the initial eight chapters are all completely separate. There's no crossover at all. There's no characters that, you know, appearing in different places or whatever. They are distinct short stories. And I called them as such in my review. Like you could play them all and just finish one and be like, okay, oh, that story's done. Like you liked it or you didn't, but it is wrapped up to some extent. They don't even really end in a way, and you know, people have played a lot of the three chapters available in the demo. I think you get about half of each of the chapters, I think, just from hearing other people talk about them,
That's what I've heard as well.
Yeah. So you're going to play another half, and it's going to wrap up, and it's going to be to a point where you're like, if this is the end, I'm okay with it. Again, whether you love it or hate it doesn't really matter, because there's a bow on it, you know? And so you can't see any obvious connection at all. And what that does is it kind of holds you back from knowing how to prepare for the end of this game. And I think that's frustrating when, you know, you play a traditional RPG and you know that kind of your actions in the middle and beginning of the game, they're going to have an impact later on, right? If you pick up an elixir in the first 2 hours and you save it for the end, it's going to be really helpful for you, you know? If you do a little bit more grinding and you feel overleveled, you're probably going to be either overleveled or good by the end of the game. You don't get that sense in this game. You can run into battles in any of the chapters, even the final chapter of the game, and be either way too strong or way too weak. And you will not know, because most of the encounters are random. You feel kind of put off, or you're kind of out of balance, you know, because you don't know what to expect from every encounter, whether it's bosses or just regular enemies. How you're going to approach that battle, you won't know until you attack them and see how much damage you do out of their health meter, or when they attack you and do 90% of your health in one attack. Until that happens, you have no idea what to prepare for or how the battle's going to go. Often I would get hit once and be like, oh, or hit someone once and be like, oh, I need to run from this because I'm not going to win this fight. And if that's happening in like 25 to 50% of your encounters, I don't think that's good game design. So that is an issue that at least came up for me. I think that came up for people that played Octopath as well, just because of the way that game was structured and you didn't know exactly how you were supposed to play it.
I think Octopath, the problem is that there wasn't flexibility. That's a game that very clearly defines that, like, you should do the first chapter of all eight characters, then move on to chapter two for all eight characters. Yeah. And I think some people desired to play the game as you played this character's four, what is it? I think they each have four chapters.
Yeah, that's right.
You play one person's four chapters, then move on and do another one. And that is extremely not how that game is designed to be played.
I guess the problem with that is you can do that in Octopath. Not that you should, and not that that's the prescribed way of the game.
You're going to have a bad time.
Here, you don't have those kind of options. Like, here's the game. You need to finish this chapter to move forward. If the enemies are too hard, you know, I don't know, run away from every battle, go fight someone else. And we're talking about basic enemies. This doesn't make any sense. Specifically in the eighth chapter, there's a situation where your main character is by themselves. They don't have a party anymore, or they don't have a party to begin with. And you're kind of running around the overworld, and you're running into these knights. And one type of knight is very easy to beat. And the other type of knight, I don't know how many hours of grinding it would take to even do half of their hit points. Like, they're just instant death if you try to fight them.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why is this happening? This situation doesn't make any sense, because I'm never going to be able to beat this enemy, again, unless I do some obscene amount of grinding that would not be fun and would not fit with the small contained space of the game that every chapter throws you into. It's not a game meant to grind, just because every space is very, very small compared to the spaces in other RPGs of this style. That's why this game is super unique, but also feels very much like an experiment, and not every part of the experiment worked out. The battle system is fun, the aesthetic is great, and, you know, doing different chapters with different styles is really cool, but I don't think the whole, it's not greater than the sum of its parts.
I mean, it's even from like that stealth chapter, like the fact that I did a little reading in it after I finished it, how if you avoid every fight and go stealth through it all, you'll get very good bonuses but then that character also won't level up at all.
Right. With the way the game works is with through leveling up, most of the time when you level up, you gain an ability. And those abilities are very helpful. And the abilities you gain later and later in levels are very strong. So leveling up is super important. So if you do a chapter where you kind of avoid a lot of fights, you flee, and then when you get to the end of the game and eventually the characters all, they do meet up for this final chapter and you play through it and so on. If your characters are super underleveled at that point and they don't have equipment that they gained from their own chapter, and you don't know what to carry forward and how thoroughly to explore, you can really be set up for failure. And again, there's no real warning that that's happening. It's very much, I think it's going to catch a lot of people off guard, unfortunately.
So, all right. As we're recording this, the review embargo is tomorrow. What do you think is going to be the Metacritic average for Live Alive on Switch?
I hate how I have to start with my score because I know what that is and work up or down from that. I'm thinking I'm going to go 78. I think it's going to be a 78.
I say 75.
I'll say 83.
Oh, I love your
optimism. Just because I think that Forbidden SNES game Fruit is... The people won't finish it. They'll just be like, SNES game I haven't played.
Yeah.
8.5.
Did that happen with Trials of Mana? I guess that's one of our only litmus tests, right? A Super Nintendo game that was never released here. I guess we got it in Collection of Mana.
Which version are you talking about?
Yeah, that's right. Because Collection of Mana has the baggage of the other two games with it. But then the remake has different baggage too.
which is funny. I mentioned about how Secret of Mana was a game that playing it, 10 years after it came out or whatever, I didn't enjoy it. Trials of Mana in Collection of Mana, I really liked it.
Yeah.
It's a lot better than Secret of Mana.
The 3D remake of Trials of Mana is at roughly a 75 on Metacritic.
Okay.
Collection of Mana is an 83 on Metacritic.
Oh, both scores that were said during our possible.
So one of you is right. One of you is right about this. Yeah. We don't know who.
I do. You know what? Anybody that says there's three must-play games for any JRPG fan in Collection of Mana is wrong, because that first game is bad. I'm willing to admit
Play it to get to the other ones.
Yeah,
so it's still a must.
I'm willing to admit that I know a lot of people like Secret of Mana, and it just, I've tried multiple times, it's never clicked for me. I will accept that a lot of people love that game. The music is very good. Mm-hmm. But Adventures of Mana, nah, dog.
But wait, Neil, have you played the PS Vita remake or PS3 remake
of
that game?
Crap, apparently
it's even worse.
Yeah.
That's what I heard.
I remember being really interested in the Secret of Mana remake that came out, and then bad that Square left it on PlayStation 4 or whatever and never brought it anywhere else.
For all the crap we can give HD 2D, if the alternative is that, I'll take the HD 2D. Thank you.
I mean, I like the Trials of Mana remake pretty good.
The Trials of Mana one is fine. It's just the Secret of Mana,
art
style, it reminded me of Golden Sun on DS, where it's like, here's beautiful pixel art. We've remade it in 3D with no money.
Yeah.
And it just was like, oh no, what did you do?
I mean, that's a lot of the stuff with the modern Mana games. And even, Mana and Saga, although I think Saga is a game that works good on a janky ass budget. Mm-hmm. It was funny seeing Trials of Mana and Final Fantasy VII Remake come out in the same month, a week away from
each
other.
That's right. I remember that. Yes.
Here is the budget priced remake, and here is the we had to put a mortgage on the entire company remake.
Yeah. I will say, I think Trials of Mana is a nice, it's definitely budget, but I think it's a very nice looking game.
Yeah, it's more, I feel like the budget for Trials of Mana really comes out in the voice acting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That game is so cartoony and colorful, and it just feels more it feels more more cartoony. It feels more like fantasy. And
it was a good choice.
I like that game a lot. I also like Final Fantasy VII Remake, and the production values of one of those games is way better.
But even then, I bet that Trials of Mana Remake costs a whole lot more than Live Alive, just because of the nature of...
Oh man, I wish we knew that. I'd be fascinated.
I'll bet. Mm-hmm. It is obviously, making games using a lot of 2D assets still requires an incredible amount of talent, but... there are parts of that are a lot simpler to do than building 3D models of everything from scratch. Because even a lot of the pixel art in Live Alive looks like it's at least drawn from elements of the original, even if it's
Totally is. Yeah, like you can look at one. I think one comparison I make or I show in the video is the boss fight for the Western chapter.
Yeah,
like you look at the art of the original and then compare it to the remake version. The boss's fight, his face looks exactly the same. Like it's really cool actually to see that kind of evolution.
Sure,
but they did feel very beholden to that original version because a lot of people have never played the Super Famicom version unless you played with the translation patch. Right,
if it's new to your audience, then why bother doing it again?
Exactly. Yeah.
Well. Did you have anything final to add on that? Or
I would be remiss to not mention the Yoko Shimomura soundtrack, which is very, very good.
Sure.
There's a jukebox feature that opens up in the game after you beat the first chapter. And every time you beat a chapter or do more in the game, more songs are added to the jukebox. So it's kind of like a little achievement system in a way. And the music is fantastic. And having a way to go back and revisit some of the tracks is really cool. Every chapter seems to have at least one or two standout songs. The boss theme is incredible. I play it through the second half of the video review. But yeah, it's a really good soundtrack. I think some of her other songs, some of her other works are a little better, but it's fantastic still. And the remastered soundtrack is definitely one worth listening to.
Awesome. Cool.
Cool.
Well, speaking of games that have good soundtracks, so I finished Xenoblade 3 earlier in the month. Review soon. But... got done with it.
Tell me all of your secrets.
Whoa, got
review
done with
soon
it.
As in like 1 minute from now. Here comes the review.
Yeah.
I mean, we can stop. I'll secretly tell you guys everything if you
is
want.
Is the ending good or bad?
I can't
blink
tell you
once.
That. Oh, I did. Did you see me?
Just blink. I want to make sure you're okay.
We finished that, and both my wife and I played the Xenoblade games together because we both really enjoy them. But we finished it, and we were both kind of in the mood to keep playing Xenoblade. But we kind of debated like, well, we could replay one of them. But instead, I was like, you know, we have this Xbox Series X, which is very good at playing old games. And I have never touched Xenogears, which is the first Xeno game. It's not at all my kind of game, but we could try that. And so we started playing that. And it is hilarious because I had played a little bit of Xenosaga. I own the first two on PS2. I've never put the second one into my PS2, and like, who knows if I'll ever make it to that one. But I played a little bit of Xenosaga and was like, okay, I get the connections here. This doesn't feel like Xenoblade, but I kind of see it. Whereas with Xenogears, you put that in, the opening crawl comes up, and we're both reading, you know, the intro text about these two nations called like Kislev and Ave have been at war for so long that nobody remembers what it's about, blah, blah, blah. And we're looking at that and we're like, boy, this is a game about countries called Kislev and Ave. We just finished a game about countries called Kevis and Agnes. Like, we're going through this story plot and we're like, wait, this is just the Xenoblade trilogy of like the numbered Xenoblade games, just like in one game. And we keep getting to points in the game. So one of the characters you meet is, his name is Bart, and you meet him as a pirate. He has an eye patch and he's kind of goofy. And we're playing this part, and I made the comment to her, I'm like, I'll bet this guy is secretly, like, I'm like, do you remember Zeke from Xenoblade 2? I'll bet this guy is just that character, and he's secretly like a prince or some shit. And his full name is probably Bartholomew. Guess what happened an hour later? Turns out that pirate dude is a prince. His name is Bartholomew. And we're like, Jesus. Like, it's, so we keep hitting these plot points where we're like, oh, I remember this plot point from Xenoblade 1, 2, or 3. And it's so weird. And obviously, like, we're experiencing it in the wrong order. But it's hilarious how Takahashi just has these certain beats he hits, apparently, and is remarkably consistent. But I will say, I'm having a great time, because it just feels like, it feels like an alternate reality Xenoblade, which I think is what I wanted it to be. And while I don't like turn-based combat, I have been amazed by how... so far, we're like maybe 9 hours in, so far how few areas there have been with random encounters. Like, it's been a lot. Like, I think in like the first 2 hours, I went through two areas where there were actually random encounters, and other than that, every encounter I've had has either been like a scripted fight, or I'm going through an area where I can see all of the enemies. And I can choose to fight them or sneak around them or whatever. And so that element of it hasn't been that big of a deal. I do wish the game explained its combat system at all.
It's not good at that.
And it's not like a super generic turn-based combat system. Like, it has some weird things. So every time I keep getting, like, I'll get to a boss fight and I'll just get owned. And so I'll Google online, like, tips for beating this guy. And the thing will be like, oh, well, you know, you should be about level 20. I'm like, okay, that's about where I am. Which means you should have, you know, ultra throwdown combos. And I'm like, what? And they're like, yeah, if you push triangle, but then cancel out of triangle, that'll build up your AP meter. If you do that like four times, then you can go into this menu and do this. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then you do that and you like one shot the boss. And it's like, boy. And obviously, I'm sure all that stuff is in the instruction book, but I'm not playing it with an instruction book. And it's just like, boy, I'm glad Google exists, because this would be a very different, horrible experience if I couldn't make use of the knowledge of others to get through it. But I've been very surprised by how much I am enjoying it so far. I've heard Disc 2 is where they ran out of money, so we'll see if I continue to enjoy it at that point. Though I've heard that
you could just read through the rest of the game.
Well, I was going to say, the Disc 2, the way in which they run out of money is that it becomes a visual novel, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, that's fine, because that's my favorite part of the game.
Yeah. I actually think Disc 2, like, because it is the kind of thing where, like, a lot of Takahashi games, I don't know if I like the story, but I appreciate, like, his commitment to insanity.
Oh, I jive so hard with his particular flavor of, like, weird, like, Christian theology-obsessed fantasy sci-fi with giant robots. Like, his flavor of that anime bullshit just... I dig it. He can recombine the exact same ingredients as many times as he likes, and it seems to work for me every time.
I mean, it's also the kind of thing too where I don't know if there's a lot of other people making the kinds of games that he's making.
Yeah, it's a unique flavor. And it's kind of hard to describe. I found it fun once you get like the gears, the big mechs, that all of their mechanics he uses in Xenoblade X. Like, the entire, whenever you're using a gear, you have a fuel gauge that constantly is going down no matter what you do, unless you stay still and don't do anything, in which case your fuel gauge slowly refills. And even the gear customization is set up in the same way that the Skell customization is in Xenoblade X. Like, it's crazy playing this and being like, whoa, everything is in this game. It's so bizarre to play.
Xenogears feels to me, I've played about half of it, maybe 60% of it, and I don't even know if I got to Disc 2 or not. I probably would have known that. I don't quite remember it.
I think we did it on a Thirsty Mage.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's right. And I specifically remember not playing it. I had the strategy guide, and I liked parts of the first half, but it feels like the type of game where if I was a teenager and, you know, I was playing it during spring break, I would have loved that experience, you know, just getting really into it. That's all I had to do. This is my one game. Maybe I rented it or I just got it new or something like that. I'm focused, laser focused on this one game. But coming back to it as an adult with a family and stuff, it's like, I just don't have time for some of this game's bullshit. You know, I applaud you, John, for you really dig this kind of storytelling and get into these kind of games, and you can kind of put up with it a little bit more. But for me, I'm just like, I eventually get to a point where I reach this meter where I'm like, I cannot tolerate anymore. I'm just like, okay, I'm going to get out at this point, you know?
It's your Atlas line.
Yeah, pretty much.
Why don't we call it the Takahashi line?
That's right. Yes, exactly.
Is it like the story elements that do that to you, or is there something about the gameplay?
I think it was the pacing. I just felt you know, I wanted a little bit more consistency. Like, I felt like there are big breaks where you're not controlling anything. You're not exploring. You're not moving. Like, the story's just going. It's like, oh, it's, you know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever at a time. And I'm like, I want to do something now. Like, my hands, my brain is ready to do some controlling and get some feedback, you know, as opposed to just reading. Yeah.
Yep. I think I played that on Vita. It was one of the last things I played.
That's
on
where
Vita.
I played it too. Yeah.
I forget if you could fast forward in that.
In the Vita version,
I don't think you can.
I don't think that's part of it. I think I might have lamented that you can't.
And you guys know how I play RPGs, right? So for me to not be able to advance
that
text or advance scenes,
yeah,
it's like, this is killing me. Like, I'm going to have a heart attack. I have to keep reading without being able to skip forward. It's just my preferred pacing for a game. Like it, I read fast. I want to go through certain scenes faster, and to be able to be held back by that is just kind of giving me this anxiety. Like, I don't have time for this. I need to get to the next thing. And so it's just that experience was not pleasant enough for me. I eventually had to put it down.
Yeah. That honestly, like with your style of playing these games, that completely makes sense. You would have hated when we started, I didn't have the emulator set up right. So we played like 2 hours in and then went to pick it up the next night, and our save state and save file were both gone.
Oh my god. No.
And so it should tell you how invested I was in the plot, that once I was confident I had fixed everything, like my wife went off to take a shower and I was like, all right, here we go. And I just speed ran the first 2 hours again, which you can't do much because like we said, you can't accelerate the text boxes.
Yeah.
So I was literally just like on my phone, just pushing X to get through text boxes.
There's a point in your life where losing that 2 hours, it goes from unfortunate to being like traumatizing. And I think at least I'm at that point where like, if I lost that 2 hours, I'm like, I just can't. I'm going to go to the next thing.
Well, and it is that point where I had that moment of like, all right, if I do this, I'm committing to this game.
You got
to
finish
because
it.
I'm not going to do the entire beginning section again, unless we're like doing the game.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the nice thing is like playing it on the Xbox is, you know, I'm able to save state constantly before boss fights and like make the game way more convenient to just play, which is allowing me, despite like, you guys know my feelings on turn-based RPGs, I really struggle to get through them, but playing it in this format and it being a game that's way more interested in telling a story than making me do combat is allowing me to get through it.
I mean, speaking of games that could use a remake,
honestly, might kind of work in the HD 2D engine.
Yeah. Don't give them any ideas.
It's all sprite based characters and 3D environments. It could kind of work.
I mean, I would love to see that happen. I think from what I know about like Takahashi's relationship with Square Enix, I think it's unlikely, which sucks because I think it's a game that would remake very nicely.
Well, and I wish this won't happen because this isn't how IPs work, but there is a large part of me that wishes Nintendo could just go to Square and going to Bandai Namco seems like it would be pretty easy. They seem like they're on good terms, but I wish they could go to Square and just be like, hey, what do you want for Xenogears? Like, let's just, we've made this Xeno series work. We want all of it. Like, what do you want for Xenogears? Just give it to us. And then go to Bandai Namco and go, what do you want for Xenosaga? Because it seems clear that like neither of those companies is interested in like re-releasing them in any real way. And I wish Nintendo just had them so that they could do a Xeno collection on their system. There is relevance in those games to fans of Xenoblade.
Mm-hmm. Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there has to be, otherwise I wouldn't be pushing through them. I'll never make it through Xenosaga, and I'll never be able to afford a copy of Xenosaga 3.
It's a lot, man.
I mean, if offbeat kind of weird RPGs were going to make it anywhere, if they were remade and we're going to make it anywhere, it would be the Switch in 20.
Now is the time.
In the early 2020s, right? Like this is the time.
Yeah, like I think Xenosaga is a series that like, no, that ain't coming back. But like Xenogears is one. I mean, yeah, Nintendo and Square should talk.
Well, and once again, HD 2D, and Nintendo has put money into multiple HD 2D games. Mm-hmm. Like
Square is running out of PlayStation era games to bring back.
That's right.
Yeah.
Like they're scraping. They brought back Live Alive for fuck's sake. Like,
yeah. This honestly feels like more, given the choice, probably pick this over Live Alive if we're choosing which games to bring back.
And it is the kind of game, like, I think if you played this in like, when did it come out, 1999? It was like the truth then. Like, I know I have some friends that like, when I was replaying it a couple of years ago, or I guess playing through it, I've like played like I played the first couple hours of it sometime in the 2000s, and then it is an immense game with bad pacing, so I fell off it. But then like I got a lot farther into it, and yeah, like I was talking with like friends who don't play a lot of video games now that were just like, oh, Xenogears was incredible. Like I played it when I was 12, and I was like, oh, okay, like that's cool. I do not feel that way. I'm glad you did when you played it back in the day.
Oh, yeah. Well, it is. I mean, it's a dense world with a lot of lore. And so, yeah, if you jive with that, then
that sounds like a John game.
Yeah, definitely.
No, I'm having a great time.
So as far as games that I don't give a crap about the lore, but of having a great time.
Good. I was trying to figure out a segue.
Fire Emblem Warriors Three Hopes. Dope. I've realized like the spot that I'm in with Fire Emblem games, and it's a spot that I've been in almost since the beginning. It's not that I don't care about the story. It just, for me, the story is not the priority for Fire Emblem games, which I think is why replaying Three Houses for like that, like, you know, the ultimate payoff, so to speak, of like seeing these different stories play out, like, was not as appealing to me. I'm into like, let me fiddle with my team, you know, level them up, I guess, like make them friends and do support things. But like build that group, build that class, as it were, and, you know, Three Houses, and I guess Three Hopes to an extent, even if you're not so much as building up your class as building an army, Three Hopes. Mm-hmm. But like, I've always enjoyed like that kind of, you know, like roster manipulation, then executing on the battlefield. And I also think I'm at a point where I might enjoy, from a laid back perspective, dicking around with a Musou game as opposed to dicking around with turn-based strategy. And yeah, that's why, like, I think I'm enjoying Three Hopes maybe not as much as I did Three Houses, but I feel like it's the fact that I think I'm on par with how I felt about Three Houses at a minimum when I'm playing Three Hopes that makes me really impressed, because I kind of pictured the game to be more of like a facsimile of what like that strong Fire Emblem experience was, which is what I kind of thought Fire Emblem Warriors was. But instead, like, I think this kind of stands next to Three Houses. Like, it's kind of a weird sequel of sorts to Three Houses, like a little bit Elseworlds in the way that like Age of Calamity is, but also kind of not, although I haven't reached the end yet, so I don't know how it all wraps up and fits into the world of Three Houses, which is honestly four separate stories that have different endings and outcomes. But it's just like Three Hopes is really good, and I like the structure of the chapters, where the way it works is kind of after you have the intro stuff, like, you know, in Three Houses you know go half of the game is solidly in the school. Three Hopes, you're out of the school in like 2 hours, so most of the game is when the world is at war, and each chapter kind of takes you through a battlefield in the theater of the war that's going on, where you'll have a couple kind of not necessarily side missions, like it's all mandatory missions, but kind of like smaller scale missions, and then there will be a big chapter ending mission. And along the way, as you complete these you know smaller missions that you need to play to progress, you also unlock side missions and other unlocks and items, and you build up your camp and your base and start to level up your characters, get new classes, get new weapons, and how it all funnels together is very enjoyable. And then the actual battles themselves, which are, you know, it's if you've played a Warriors game, you'll feel at home. But the thing that this does that I really appreciate is that it feels like the character AI is a lot better, and kind of mimicking how Fire Emblem works as a turn-based strategy game. You control a character, but then all the other characters in the battlefield, which can range from three others to seven others, you can send them all over the battlefield and kind of basically like manipulate your roster like you're sending them out in a turn-based strategy game. And yeah, it's just, I've really sincerely enjoying this game so much, and I'm taking my time with it, which I think is the best way to do it, because it gets very repetitive in its gameplay at moments, but it's just a good ass time. Now, Jordan, I know you've been playing it too.
Yeah, it you know what, it does that thing really well, Neil, of constantly seeing meters go up, you're collecting resources, yep, that you spend, and things get better and levels go up, and, you know, stats increase, and it does that really good thing of constantly making you feel like your camp is improving, your characters are getting stronger and noticeably stronger. Like, you feel when you change to a new class and you have like new special attacks and finishing moves, you see like more enemies take damage and the damage numbers go up. You know that you are really wrecking face at that point. And I love the way, especially like I played mostly with the main character, Shez, and
She's awesome.
I played as female Shez, and she was just, I used her so much, and she was just so powerful. It was just dumb. I was just running through people at the end, and not a complaint. Like I played it. I designed it that way for myself, but like, I felt so powerful with her throughout the whole game. I made use of like a three or four other characters sparingly, but often just to like ally them with Shez. So let's just like you can do in Fire Emblem. Traditional games, you can pair two characters together to make one, to make them stronger, right? And so the character in the lead, who would for me would be Shez, I'm going through the maps with her, but then when I bring in the other character for like special moves and stuff, it's just, you're just so devastating on the battlefield. Bosses are going down, even those giant demons that you fight sometimes, like bringing them down pretty quick. And so it felt like I could play that game at a really fast pace, which I enjoyed, because you know, sometimes with Warriors games you keep getting all these objectives and you keep having to go back and forth and back and forth. This game felt, just even the individual maps and battles felt better paced than other Warriors games I played. So just getting through the smaller maps faster, and then you lead up to the larger like chapter ending battle after feeling like you've made a lot of good improvements there and you feel ready for that chapter. It does another thing of you get points to spend in the final chapter on strategizing.
It's so cool.
It's really, really cool. Like you can bring in like catapults, or you can bring in healers, or make your strongholds tougher.
And that's also how you can spend points to recruit. I mean, yes. much like Three Houses, like you can kind of, you know, I picked Black Eagles, but I've recruited a couple people from the other houses, because in those moments you can spend those strategy points to be like, okay, when you see Ignatz, you can recruit him after you defeat him in battle.
Yeah. So that's the way you expand your army. And you don't necessarily need to feel like I played on classic mode. And so if a character dies, they die. And I was losing characters, you know, on occasion, but I felt like my roster kept getting bigger. So I was like, oh, I'm still going to have people to new characters to play as and recruit and join my party. And then I get to play in a, you know, meet all these characters that I remember from Three Houses. And it was just fun. That's how they got integrated in the game, through doing some of the smaller maps and then choosing a strategy to recruit them. So it's very much feels like an optional thing. And I like that. If you want to expand, yeah, or you want to just keep, like I played as Black Eagles as well in this game, not in Three Houses. I played as Golden Deer, I think.
Hey, what's up, friend? I did Golden Deer in Three Houses. I actually started a Black Eagles replay, I think it was like May or something.
Okay.
And I did not get through the entire first half, but it was kind of nice. Like I had kind of gotten used to the Black Eagles squad. So then I just came into Three Hopes, and like they're like, okay, we're just gonna fast forward what you kind of replayed in Three Houses.
That's it.
And go down this other path.
It worked out well that you just played the first half, and then you kind of get get the rest of the game in Three Hopes, right? But yeah, so I did that as well, and yeah, Edelgard was obviously super powerful for me as well. Like I kind of pushed her to being like this really heavily armored knight. And one of the cool things is, depending on the classes that you have, you can manipulate the battlefield. So for example, like an armored knight can destroy a breakable wall, opening up a new path in the battlefield. Yep. Pegasus knights or flying knights can cross certain gaps that other characters can't. So you can get to objectives faster or get back to a point you have to defend faster or something like that. So just even the way of traversing different types of battlefields felt really cool too. It's a really interesting game. And I feel like people always preface this, I'm not a huge Musou fan, or I am a huge Musou fan. It doesn't really matter. I think anyone could play and enjoy this game, even if you have a passing knowledge or a passing interest in Three Houses or not. It just feels pretty well made.
We're coming up on almost a decade since Hyrule Warriors. I think I just need to get to the point where I say I'm a fan of Musous. It's just a specific type of them.
So I'm someone who tried, I have liked previous Fire Emblem games, but I tried Three Houses and just bounced off it so hard, mostly because of the school stuff. You say this one fast forwards through that. My main question is like, should I know the story of Three Houses before I play it?
So I have been reaching the point where there'll be like, look at this guy. I'm like, who the fuck is this guy?
Yeah, me too. That happened to me a bunch too.
Because it's also, it does like reference like the DLC house.
Yes, it does. I'm like, who are these people?
The game, if you want to get more information on characters, it's in the game.
Okay.
Sometimes you kind of have to seek it out more. I mean, you can also just like Google it. But I think also Googling it as Three Hopes is more in existence is going to be a little bit more precarious, because it might start spoiling some of the stuff that happens in Three Hopes. Whereas, you know, when I was kind of Googling this stuff, like early, you know, closer to when Three Hopes came out, it would just be like, oh, this is what they did in Three Houses. Okay, so this is like a little bit different than how they were used in Three Hopes. But I don't, I mean, I know you're also more of a lore guy than I am. I did kind of introduce this game as like, it's a game where I don't care about the lore as much. It's a lot more like, you know, you do get the interaction between characters, and I think you get a lot of personality built up through that, that there are specific, you know, story aspects that I think would potentially get a little lost on you if you don't have familiarity with Three Houses. But I think my best advice would be try the demo. And if you're into what that game is selling in the demo, then you would probably enjoy the full game. Because that's kind of okay. What I did is I finished the demo and then like the next day went to GameStop and bought the game. Like that's that was my arc of getting
this is
game.
A save transfers from the demo to the full game kind of thing.
Yeah, right? Straight up playing almost the first four chapters entirely. Like it's okay, it's a beefy demo. It's like 3-4 hours of content.
It's a beefy game. I mean, it's got 16 full chapters. Like, there's a lot of optional fights. Like, there's a lot of content here. And that's just one route, right? Just one path is 16 chapters.
I think Matt said it took him, like, 60 hours to finish a single route. So
Matt's ridiculous, but...
Yeah.
Well, we can't all be as fast at games as you, Jordan.
It's true. I just play this when game. Really fast.
Did you roll credits on Three Hopes?
I did, yeah. So about, I think it was around 18 to 20 hours, something like that.
Okay, I will tell you this much. I think I'm on like chapter 7 or 8 and I'm at like 11 hours.
I'm not
finishing it in that amount of time. But also I think Matt, and it's maybe a little bit you playing on Classic as well, I think Matt did like all of the side content.
Yes, there's a lot of it.
There's a lot of paralogues and stuff that I'm starting to unlock. And I'm not playing on Classic, so although I've only had, I think I had like one character died in battle so far, so it's, I wouldn't even really lost that many. But I'm playing Three Hopes like I play Pokemon games, where, I mean, Shez is definitely my destroyer of worlds, so is Edelgard, but I like kind of keep almost everybody around the same level going forward. Although I do find myself, I'm like a level or two under leveled from the level recommendation for everything as I'm going forward, likely because of the way that I'm playing. So I am thinking as it's happening, I'm like, I should probably just like pick a couple characters and make sure they're kind of my like top dogs. But I am enjoying like going deeper through the roster and kind of giving everybody their time to shine, seeing how different characters handle, because like the classes are kind of like, there's a similarity between how they handle. Like, I feel like if you're, you know, you have your lance wielders, your axe wielders, your sword wielders, and they all kind of feel vaguely similar. But then every character kind of has like a unique ability and, and these specific things about them that make them all a little bit unique, even if there is kind of a basic way that they all control. Like, I don't find these characters to be as like vibrant and ridiculous and fun as the Age of Calamity character roster.
I mean,
even Hyrule Warriors had some awesomeness there, but like I love the way like Hestu feels in Age of Calamity, and I don't think there's a character in Three Hopes that really does it as well. It does get me thinking, because I and it's something that Age of Calamity does very well additionally, is that they both, well, one, it's that structure of like giving you some bite-sized Musou levels building up to a bigger one, which is what Age of Calamity and Three Hopes both do constantly. But it's the adaptation of like taking this popular game. I think Fire Emblem Three Hopes feels more like a regular Fire Emblem game than Age of Calamity feels like a regular Zelda game. But they both take elements of Breath of the Wild and Three Houses and translate them into a way that like it does not feel like, oh, they just brought Zelda games into a Musou world. It's like, no, they married Breath of the Wild or Three Houses with Musou games. Mm-hmm. And I was starting to think earlier today, as I knew I was going to talk about this game, what other Nintendo franchises could you do that with? And I think I realized why they just alternate doing Hyrule Warriors and Fire Emblem Warriors, because I don't think there's another series that really could, you know, do that creative expansion of what that, how that game plays and mixing it with a Warriors game.
Yeah.
Like, the only one, F-Zero Warriors, because it has the roster, I don't know how you reckon the racing game aspect of that with the Musou combat.
I think it's Pikmin. I think Pikmin has to be Pikmin the next Warriors game.
Yeah. But Pikmin, I don't know if it really has, once again, Pikmin, I don't think has the roster.
Well, listen, you take the yellow Pikmin, you give it boobs, and congratulations, you have a new original character for your Warriors game.
Maybe this is what Pikmin 4 has been all along, a Warriors game.
Yeah. Splatoon Warriors is another one that I was kind of rolling around.
Like some weird lore that you could like spin into weird directions for a Warriors game.
I think the thing with that is that a lot of Splatoon combat's ranged, and I don't know how that would work within the framework. Star Fox Warriors is once again, I mean, I think that's one that like people have kind of joked about. I think wasn't it Koei Tecmo asked about that and Nintendo was like, nah, dog.
I feel like it might have come up, but that's another one where like, are you going to do it in space like that?
Yeah.
Or or is it just like, is it like Star Fox Adventures Warriors?
I think if you were to do Star Fox, it has to be Star Fox Adventures Warriors, which, oh God, I would play the hell out of that.
And that's the thing. The best Nintendo Warriors games have been the ones where they take an existing game and do an alternate reality version of it. So yeah, if they opened it up to be like, it doesn't have to be a current game, we're going to go to this GameCube game and do an alternate reality version of this GameCube game. Holy shit, yes.
Yeah, like, that'd be great.
Do every Zelda game. Like, just any Zelda game. But yeah, then pick random stuff. Custom Robo Warriors.
I think what would be another good one? I mean, Pokemon Warriors, I feel like that's a concept that could work.
Yeah, people do like edgy, violent Pokemon now.
That's
a thing. There's that first person shooter for some reason.
Surely there's enough Pokemon that either are swords or hold sword like things, you know, that you could have you could have a pretty good roster there.
Well, speaking of swords, Xenoblade.
Well, that was another one that was on my short list of mental things. Okay. I think you have the character roster, but how do you blend Xenoblade gameplay into a Warriors game? Because I feel like at a certain point, it's just like the combat, but like a little faster.
Well, I think you do. I think you specifically do Xenoblade 2, and so that characters can have multiple blades that they're switching between. You could like unlock new blades that would have different move sets. Some of them could be very ridiculous. So you'd get your Hetsu stuff from Age of Calamity.
From the boob fish or whatever.
And then they've already done stuff in the Xenoblade games of like, I'm pretty sure that canonically Shulk, Rex, and Elma have all met, and Cosmos from Xeno Saga. So like, nothing you do in Xenoblade Warriors could ever get weirder than things that already happened in Xenoblade 2.
That's a good point.
So like, do whatever you want. It's fine.
Yeah, maybe that could work. And I mean, that also kind of does fit the criteria of like, I feel like if they're going to follow this pattern, it would be a game that had a recent success.
Yeah.
Metroid Warriors absolutely wouldn't work because it's a game about like solitude, unless you want to make it like Metroid Prime Federation Force Warriors, in which case, let's go. I'm all in.
Do you guys expect that there'll be another Zelda Warriors game after Breath of the Wild 2, maybe like a companion game to that? And then same thing with the new Fire Emblem game. Will there be another Warriors game after that at some point that links back to? Do you expect that that'll be the pattern?
I think it'll be a while.
Yeah,
but yes to both
at some point.
With Zelda, do you make an alternate reality Breath of the Wild 2, or do you make a sequel to Age of Calamity?
Or with Zelda, because if you think about it, there's I guess it's only 3 years from God. Age of Calamity is almost 2 years old. I feel like it would be a little bit longer of a time before we'd get to a Hyrule Warriors game that would be like Age of Calamity to Breath of the Wild. I mean, maybe you have Hyrule Warriors 2, which would, I mean, delight people who love stupidly named video games. And you make Hyrule Warriors 2 that follows up on the story of the first Hyrule Warriors and then introduces more Links and Zeldas and crap.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, once again, there are a whole lot of other Zelda games you could make alternate realities of.
Yeah.
Wind Waker Warriors is fun to say.
Maybe Ocarina of Time remake is a Warriors game.
That could work.
I would play that game for the rest of my life.
there's that whole Hylian Civil War thing that gets homaged a lot in the series that they've never shown.
Yeah.
It's sitting right there. Make that game.
Yeah, and I just feel like with the timing of everything, and maybe COVID got in the way a little bit, it'll just be a while before we'll see if a Hyrule Warriors or Fire Emblem Warriors is going to like directly respond to the next game in the series. Mm-hmm. I mean, now we're at a point where we haven't seen the next game in either series.
Yeah, we don't have any early numbers on Fire Emblem yet, right? For Three Hopes.
I would expect it did fine. I just don't know if it's like incredible or
right. Because like Age of Calamity, like based on that, right? Based on Age of Calamity's numbers, every Warriors game should be an alternate reality of a Nintendo franchise.
Yeah, like, yeah, that's what I'm thinking too, right? Like if Three Hopes is significantly up there compared to Fire Emblem Warriors, the original mm-hmm. one, yeah, you got to think that, oh, alternate reality, that's what we're going to do for every Warriors game from this point right. on.
And, you know, granted, you're working with Fire Emblem as opposed to Zelda, so like probably expect slightly lower numbers, but
sure.
even still, yeah, you have a great comparison point with the previous.
That's it, right? You can know how much better it did when we did this yeah. story version directly linked to a previous game in the series.
Yeah,
just looking at it, I mean, we're at a point where it's just like Japan and UK numbers are in, which is like here's 2% of sure. the world.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, it seems like news is good so far, good. But we'll find out. I think, but probably. Might be a while because I think we'll have to wait until like Q3 results just because of when it came out. But yeah, I mean, I love these Warriors games that Nintendo's making. Like Age yeah. of Calamity is incredible, and I think Three Hopes is equally as good. They're honestly some of my favorite games of the past couple years, and Age of Calamity, I still haven't played all the damn DLC. I gotta go through that.
Yeah. Me neither.
Yeah. I think I'm in the same boat, Neil. I think that now I've gone from like a casual fan of like Nintendo produced or, you know, Nintendo properties in Musou games to like whatever the next one is, I'm probably going to buy it just because I've loved the last two so much where the story really grabs me and they do really interesting gameplay things that, you know, whether it's that progression or the characters or whatever it is, there's something else enticing about it. So it's not just button mashing. Yes, there is button mashing. That is an inherent yeah. part of this game.
Mm-hmm. But there's enough strategy with it that there is, like, yeah. it's not mindless. I mean, it can get mindless, but like there's enough other things going on in the game that's not all of it. Like what kind of shocked me about Three Hopes is how much like it wasn't just mission to mission to mission.
Mm-hmm.
It does have like John, if you had a lot of fun kind of like upgrading all the crap for different characters in Age of Calamity, this is mm-hmm. that is all there in a mm-hmm. slightly different wrapper.
Yeah,
what I love is you go to the blacksmith and you can upgrade your weapon like 50 times. And you just have this super stupidly powerful weapon. And you're like, well, this person is undefeatable at this point. Like, there's no way this character will lose because they're dealing out so much damage. And you can do that in this game. Like, you can really customize everything to your particular playstyle and your flavor. Like, whatever kind of weapon you want to use, class, how strong you want that weapon to be. You can focus all of your resources and your upgrading of your buildings on just having the best kit for one character. And that's really cool. How you can shape your experience with this game so much. Not just the paths, not just the recruiting characters, but when you're in the camp, all the little things you can do to prepare, it's totally world is your oyster there.
Yeah. Well, we were going to talk about Stray, but we're going a little long, so I'll just say that Jordan and I started Stray. Yes. It seems neat. It has a cute cat.
I want to finish it. That's after 30 minutes, that's my evaluation so far. I want to finish it.
And I don't think it's that long, right? I think it's only 4 or 5
hours. It's a narrative adventure. So
you're probably almost done it then.
I'm at least 90% of the way through at this point.
Yeah, I assume that your 30 minutes versus my hour and a half, you're probably much farther than I am.
I'm like, as soon as I learned the cat can sprint, the game was practically over at that point.
That would have been nice to know, or I didn't learn that until the game taught me.
Yes,
I should have pushed random buttons. But we are going to go ahead to a little bit of listener mail to end off the show with from Chariot Goblin, who writes in and says, "Hey, Connectivity, been a while since I wrote an email. Got a short one. Wasn't sure what to write about, but I recently saw some Yuji Naka tweets. I have two questions. What's going on with Yuji Naka? And would you trust Yuji Naka to make a Star Fox game. Thanks and keep up the great work.
First off, what's going on with Yuji Naka is, as far as I can tell, he's been kind of a bitter prick for his entire career. And I liked games that he's made, but dating back to like working on the early Sonic games, he's been difficult to work with.
He's always been a problem.
Yeah, there's been some, I think he definitely took some credit about the creation of Sonic from like Naoto Oshima and I think some other people at Sega, and definitely took that like father of Sonic role that really like there's multiple parents for Sonic. And I think
was it him or was it the programmer? Like they had to separate them for Sonic 2. Like one group went to America and one group stayed in Japan. Like,
yep.
There were crazy creative differences.
Naka got sent to America. And I believe there's some stories about how he talked in Japanese around like, you know, American developers that also knew Japanese. And like said terrible things about them, but assumed that they didn't know what he was saying. And like, yeah, there's stuff like that. And even recently, I mean, I do think what happened, I mean, he might have been very difficult to work with on Balan, but I do think with what happened near the end of Balan's release does seem like it was kind of a shitty move to him, regardless of what might have spurred Square Enix from kind of cutting bait with him. Because when that game came out, it was his ass being dragged through the mud. It wasn't. I forget whatever the Naoto Oshima's company is called.
Not
blanking on it. R-Tune or R-Zest. R-Zest.
R-Zest
is not great. Is maybe or not consistent is the way to phrase R-Tune and R-Zest. Blinks the Time Sweeper. If you have an Xbox, it's kind of a good time. I'd check it out. But yeah, the most recent thing with him was he had the tweet about like, it's been like 25 years since Knights came out or whatever. And it was a picture that he straight up cut out Naoto Oshima.
Yeah, so funny.
which is kind of amusing. I will say after that stuff, I'm just tired of the drama with him. So I unfollowed him on Twitter because I'm like, you know what? I don't really need to see what he's doing anymore. It was kind of cute for a while seeing him say things, and I do really appreciate like his work on like Let's Tap and Let's Catch. Those are very fun Wii games for me. And I'll probably loosely keep an eye on whatever he does next. But yeah, like I need to there's certain legacy people in the world of video games that I don't feel the need to keep tabs on as closely anymore because it just kind of sucks.
Yeah. As for would you trust him to make a Star Fox game, I assume this part's a joke, but like no.
Yeah. Rodea wasn't terrible.
Neil, have you played Rodea?
One of the Rodeas isn't terrible.
They're all terrible. There's just one that's better. Like, it's not. Rodea on Wii isn't a good
was
game.
He involved that was with just the Wii Knights game? Because the Wii Knights game was not good.
I have no idea.
I didn't. He's not Izuka. It was a Sonic Team game. I don't think.
Okay.
John, would you rather have Yuji Naka's Star Fox game or nobody's Star Fox game? My question. Like, if we couldn't have one at all, you'd still rather have nothing?
If they came out and they were like, Yuji Naka is in charge of the next Star Fox game, I might not buy it.
Like, that's a scathing indictment of Yuji Naka.
You'd Balan Wonderworld.
Yeah, it's like, the important thing I need to say about Yuji Naka is Yuji Naka is a bad game designer. He's gotten lucky a couple times because he's been surrounded by people who are better at game design than he is. But Yuji Naka is bad at making games, and we all need to accept that and move on. He seems like a nice dad. His tweets about going to movies with his kids, very sweet. But he's bad at making games. He just got lucky with being around the right people at the right time early on and has coasted on that through a bunch of bad games since. Stop letting him make games. And I think we are getting to the point where it seems like slowly companies are like, this guy's bad at making games and also an asshole. We don't want to work with him anymore.
Yep.
So, you know, hopefully, I really doubt Nintendo's looking at the incredible success of Balan Wonderworld and going, we should give him a Star Fox game.
I will say, if we're talking about fantastic assholes throughout video game history, Nintendo did give a Star Fox game to Hideki Kamiya.
Yeah, but
That at least one he works. Makes good games.
Right. That's like, it's one thing. It's, yeah, you can be an asshole so long as you have results.
Yeah, like, guess what? Like, Bayonetta, Beautiful Joe, and Okami are like the best of those types of games on the planet. The Wonderful 101 is a video game, but like,
The Wonderful 101 is still better than anything Yuji Naka made.
It's not as bad as Balan Wonderworld.
Kimiya also has his hands on Devil May Cry. Like he's... Yeah. It's at the point where, like, and it's kind of how I feel about Platinum Games as a whole, is that, like, the people, like, specifically Kamiya has made so many games that I'm like, no, that is just, like, incredible, that I will loosely pay attention to whatever they make next, even if I might not enjoy it. Mm-hmm. Because, like, guess what? Like, Beautiful Joe and Okami and I mean, like, the Bayonetta games are just incredible. Can we go knock down the doors of Capcom and be like, give me Beautiful Joe back, please? Modern platforms, let's go.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I am a strong supporter of separating art from artist. So that's, you know, stuff like Bayonetta, where it's, you know, hey, the art's good, even if the artist seems like a prick. Whereas with Yuji Naka, it's like, no matter which side of that equation you look at, it doesn't wind up being good.
Yeah. But I guess if there is some kind of named historical game maker outside of Nintendo to be handed a Star Fox game, who would you want it to be?
Sakurai.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good answer.
The dude, like, he's already made one of the best Star Fox games ever in Kid Icarus Uprising. Like,
he really did.
Like, it's like, dude, give hit. Like, it's, he clearly, like, he gets what makes that kind of gameplay work. And yeah, like, that's not a, if I could choose anyone, it would be Sakurai. Give him infinite money and let him make the ridiculously long Star Fox game that he would undoubtedly make with some weird, dumb control mechanic that would still work.
You'd have to get him out of the Smash dungeon first. Like,
he's out.
Is he out?
They're done. I hope he gets, like, he got until some sort I see, of vacation
until I
or something.
See his next game. Until I see his next game, I don't know that he's done.
Like, I assume he's at least, like, on a dead. Break.
Maybe done for now. Done for now, I would believe. Like, I believe that he might not be working on the next Smash as of this minute, but I don't know that he'll never come back to it.
I kind of hope that part of bringing Bandai Namco in to work on Smash was to, like, transition it. And maybe make him less, because that's,
he's just had such a hands-on approach to the whole thing for so long.
He's such an incredible game designer. Yeah. Why do we have him working on same fighting game over and over again?
Medios is great.
Yeah, like, it's this. Yeah, it's man.
I mean, at this point, it's been, like, longer that it's been offline than it was ever online. But I did a freelance article for 1UP, like, years and years ago. But it was going into some old Sakurai stuff about, I think it was before Kid Icarus came out, about how his design philosophy of just, like, breaking down a game concept to its elements and then, like, putting it back together like a puzzle.
Yeah.
And it's something that, like, really does come through when you look at what he did with fighting games with Smash Brothers, with racing games with Kirby Air Ride, with puzzle games with Meteos, with Star Fox games with Kid Icarus. Like, it's very much this thing of, like, okay, this is what people commonly make for this game. Let me go back to the starting point and be like, I mean, it's with Kirby Air Ride, it's as simple as the reason why in Kirby Air Ride you automatically go forward no matter what is because when you're playing a racing game, your hand's just on the gas. Your finger's on the gas the whole time, except for very brief moments. So why not reverse that and have it where when you put your finger down, it actually is when you brake or drift, as opposed to always pressing that button down.
Yeah. It's the same philosophy that got us Mario 64. Like, it's that ability to take a thing and understand more than just, I'm going to duplicate what we've already done. It's understanding why a thing worked. It's something that the people who worked on Sonic are still struggling to understand to this day.
Yeah. And give Sakurai Sonic. That would be fascinating.
That would be, well, that's the thing is, I, all you got to do, here's the secret as a professional game designer. Let me just tell you that the secret to making Sonic work is to make a game where speed is the point and not a problem. Make a game where Sonic's running away from something. Like, this is a very simple, like, you gotta, if you want that to be the mechanic, you have to build the game around that, not just make Mario or Breath of the Wild or Mario Galaxy, even though that one kind of worked. Make a game about the thing you want to make a game about. Don't just say he's fast and also it's Breath of the Wild. Like, it is the opposite of what Sakurai is good at doing. So yeah, give him a Sonic game. Anyway, I think we can call that an episode.
I think we can. We talked about Yuji Naga, we talked about Star Fox, we hit our quota.
Yeah. So thank you guys very much for joining me. If you are listening to this in a format where you can rate, review it, please do that. If you would like to send in an email about Yuji Naka or anybody else, you can do that by sending it to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. You can also hit us up on Twitter @connectivitynwr. You can go to nintendoworldreport.com for a lot more if you're not already listening to that here. And I think that's everything. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
This was made possible by our generous supporters on Patreon. Check out patreon.com/NWR for all the details.